Fantastic. Super. Hi, everyone. I'm Kane Chanat, currently serving as the Associate Director of Cultural Collections at UTAS, University of Tasmania, and I'm joining all of you from Lutruwita, Tasmania, lands of the Palawa people. And I'd like to pay my respect to our elders who are with us today, our ancestors, and also our traditional leaders emerging. Actually, it gives me a lot of pleasure to introduce this next panel, and I'm waving at all of them. There are tiny windows on my screen at the moment, waving from across the Pacific. And firstly, we have Hialoha Johnston, who is the Curator of Asian Pacific Women's Cultural History at the Smithsonian Institution. And she currently is dialing in from Kaiwiki, Hawaii. As an art historian, Hialoha has also worked with various contemporary art galleries, arts and cultural nonprofit organizations, and the Honolulu Museum of Art, amongst others. And she's going to be joined by Drew Kahuaina Broderick, who is an artist, a curator, educator, and currently serving as the director of Koa Gallery at Kapi'olani Community College, based at the University of Hawaii. Previously, he worked on the artist collective Paradise Cove and also operated an RE called ACPF Projects, as well as other initiatives. And finally, I'd like to invite the facilitator for this panel, my esteemed colleague, Professor Greg Lehman, who is the professor, Pro Vice Chancellor of Aboriginal Leadership at the University of Tasmania. And for those of you who were present at the previous panel will already know this, as the co-curator of the exhibition Too Many Cooks at the Plimsoll Gallery. Greg is also a descendant of the Chabulwai people of Northeast Tasmania and writes extensively on Tasmanian colonial history and visual representation of Aboriginal people. So, Greg, are you there? Because I can't see you on my window.
Yes. Can you hear me, Kane?
Yes, I can. Yeah, thanks, Greg. So in this panel, Hialoha and Drew will address histories of the Kealakekua Bay and Hawaii while considering the Captain Cook Monument located there as well. And this discussion is going to be based off provocations by four artists who produce works in Hawaii: Gay Chan, who's a conceptual artist and educator; Sean Connelly, who's an architect, an artist, and urban ecologist; Corey Kamehanao Kala Tao, who's an artist and arts practitioner; and Lawrence Seward, who's an artist and organizer. Four of these artists who responded to the call for interventionist proposals that revisit the Kealakekua Bay and rework the Captain Cook Monument. Of course, my introduction does not even begin to capture the breadth and the richness of these artist practices and our presenters as well. So I would definitely encourage you to familiarize yourself with their work, read the biographies and the program. So with that, I think I will hand over the floor to our overview.
Thank you, Kane, for that introduction. Four contemporary artists from Hawaii, whose work you'll see in a few minutes, reinterpret and imagine new possibilities for the Captain Cook Monument mounted at Kealakekua Bay, Hawaii, where the sculpture stands as a commemoration of Cook's death in 1779. Using a variety of media and coming from divergent perspectives and cultural backgrounds, the artists offer unrealized alternatives to the monument, while suggesting multiple approaches to address the visual legacy of Captain Cook. More a call to action than an alternative in some cases, each of the four artists respond in their own ways to the historical circumstances and contemporary implications of the Cook Monument. A cursory description of King Colonial Pu'u and Captain Cook's encounters, drawing upon 19th and 20th century Hawaii Bay scholars and Kanaka Wivi scholars, is provided and then followed by a brief discussion of the contemporary context. So let me begin. Hawaiian oral histories and written accounts describe interactions between the people of Hawaii with foreigners centuries prior to Cook's arrival, although the consequence of earlier encounters did not produce the catastrophic result induced by Cook and his crew. Hawaii's encounters with Captain Cook occurred on the third and final expedition, where two British ships, the Discovery and the Resolution, anchored at different locations in the archipelago. first in January of 1778, and then again later that same year in November. It is well known that Cook was killed in Hawaii, yet the events surrounding his death and the art historical references of them tend to draw more often upon Euro-American sources that do not include Kanakaweewee accounts. Native accounts are by and large eclipsed by the fateful interaction depicted in the widely reproduced prints by British artists, such as the one that that Greg and the other panelists earlier introduced. Written sources culled by Hawaii-based scholar Abraham Fornander during the 19th century and later by Kanakaweewee scholar Stephen Deshaies in the early 20th century describe with consistency the overwhelmingly hospitable reception Cook received in his two visits to Hawaii, with the majority of documented interactions involving King Kalaniopuu at Kealakekua, where Cook anchored for 17 days. Fornander and Davita Malo, one of Hawaii's foremost 19th century Kanaka scholars, also described the many ways Captain Cook and his crew wore out their welcome. And I quote that from Fornander. Kalaniopuu organized elaborate ceremonies, fed the visitors, supplied them with water and provisions, and even gifted Cook and high-ranking crewmen the artfully made ahuula and mahiole, which are magnificent ancestral belongings created of feather and fiber. Kalaniopuu's kahuna made exceptions to kapu, and kapu are time periods where particular actions are restricted by law. In order to accommodate the visitors, Cook and his crew, which set a rare precedent but ensured that the two ships would be made capable to set sail after the crew spent weeks consuming exorbitant amounts of food and resources and knowingly transmitted diseases that would prove fatal or cause sterility among the Kanakaweewee population. Malo and Fornander describe an astute Kanaka population who had worn weary of the seemingly insatiable needs of the captain and his crew. The British ships departed Kealakekua Bay on February 4th, 1779, but returned to that same location on February 11th after their ships were damaged at sea and were in need of repair. Kealakekua Bay was under kapu at this time. No one sailed out to greet the British ships. No Kanakaweewee engaged in trade, and no attention was paid to the ships anchored yet again at Kealakekua. Captain Cook was given permission to anchor and allowed space on land to accommodate the repair of his ships. What transpired is a series of events that culminated in the death of Cook. Accounts describe the scene differently, but versions compiled by Fornander consider the variations and suggest that one of the ships, the British ships, fired upon a canoe in the ocean, killing a chief named Kalimu. Captain Cook engaged in an argument with a man avenging Kalimu's death. Other accounts suggest Cook attempted to hold Kalaniopuu hostage, which instigated Kanakaweewee to safely return their king and avenge his captor. By most accounts, Cook shot a Kanaka with a gun and shot and killed another man who threw a stone at him. The situation escalated. Cook swung a sword at Chief Kalaimano Kaho'ovaha, also known as Chief Kana'ina, and that chief held Cook in a tight grip where either he or someone else killed Cook. The retaliation for the death of Cook was firing of arms toward the Kanaka from the British ships, killing many Hawaiians and inflicting damage to the land. John Weber, the official artist aboard the Third Voyage, did not actually witness the death of Cook. The event's portrayal was imagined, painted, and engraved, and reproduced a few years later, approximately in 1781 to 1783. This visual narrative of a British hero, fully dressed in uniform and killed abroad in service to his country by the treacherous Kanakaweewee, circumnavigated the globe many times over by way of print reproduction, reaching places Cook himself never visited. The acts of hostility toward and killing of Kanakaweewee by Captain Cook and his crew members are left unrepresented in Weber's visual rendition and are unarticulated in the inscription at the Captain Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay. Sadly, the people killed by the crew and Cook himself are not commemorated on those same grounds, nor are the names of the alii and the kahuna who negotiated peace after the violence ensued. Drew?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. On August 12, 2017, in Charlottesville, Virginia, a white nationalist rally protesting the removal of a public outdoor equestrian statue of American Confederate General Robert E. Lee erupted in violence. This collision of worldviews sent shockwaves throughout the continental United States of America and its island holdings. In the wake of the deadly event, reinvigorated by contentious actions and their affiliated histories, government officials, private corporations, community organizations, and concerned individuals on local and national and international levels responded by calling for the deliberate removal of statues, markers, and monuments that memorialized Civil War era Confederacy. Confederate figures, and by extension their actions and beliefs, were to be erased from the public sphere worldwide. On August 26, 2017, 2 weeks after the event in Charlottesville, Virginia, the tremors it generated passed through three tectonic plates and surfaced in Sydney, Australia's Hyde Park in an act of so-called vandalism. This time, the actions were directed against a colonial statue of a British explorer, Captain Cook, which had been marked with black spray paint. Change the date. No pride in genocide. Today, 3 years after these events, waves of protest against structural oppression, police brutality, and white supremacy continue to crash across the globe. With the most recent rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, public statues, monuments, and memorials that honor racist figures have been passionately beheaded, pushed over, tied up, set on fire, hung from street light posts, and dumped in rivers. Among those removed and targeted for removal are statues of Confederate States of America soldiers, two U.S. presidents, an Italian colonizer, pictured here, Atlantic slave traders, and a genocidal Belgian king. Symbols of violence are falling, Black and Indigenous people of color are rising, and yet the Captain Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay remains. Although Hawaii does not bear the weight of Confederate histories, the archipelago certainly has its fair share of problematic monuments. As any place does, especially one located at an intersection of global navigation routes and power projections, both intentional and accidental. Buffered by the ocean at the crossroads of the Pacific, Hawaii has felt and continues to feel the legacies of colonialism in unique ways. Presently at Kealakekua Bay, a monument stands in commemoration of Captain James Cook, who met his death near the spot. On the base of the white obelisk is the following inscription: In memory of the great circumnavigator, Captain James Cook, RN, who discovered these islands on the 18th of January AD 1778 and fell near this spot on the 14th of February AD 1779. This monument was erected in November AD 1874 by some of his fellow countrymen. It's strange because no matter how many times I read that, I just can't get discover these islands. It never sits well, no matter how many times I see it. Given that it has been nearly a century and a half since the monument was initially set in place, why hasn't its significance and continued existence been challenged or reimagined, especially by artists? While the removal of such objects from public view helps to materially address historical injustices, and in doing so reform collective consciousness, it is unclear whether or not such a subtractive approach also addresses the structural violence at the foundation of American and European society. Is subtraction a long-term solution to living with traumatic histories? Are the issues at stake in the removal of statues, markers, and monuments actually being worked through? Or are we just ensuring that they go unaddressed and repressed once and for all? When it comes to balancing histories, some advocate for an additive approach, the inclusion of additional elements. Such an approach might make visible, accurate, publicly sourced postscripts that reflect ancestral and contemporary perspectives while acknowledging the various custodians of contested lands and waters. Decolonization isn't simply deconstructing systems and sites of power by critically examining colonialism and its harbingers. Asserting points of reference outside the binaries, outside of Euro-American markers, to tell histories on different terms and with cultural specificity is another important part of the process. Monuments are certainly not forever, but in what directions do their removal or revision move us beyond forward and backwards? Perhaps there are other ways to address whitewashed histories and legacies of colonialism with more nuance towards regenerative ends. The four artist videos that follow by Gay Chan, Sean Connolly, Lawrence Seward, and Corey Kamehanokala Holt-Tom offer a glimpse into a larger group project initiated in 2018. Revisiting Kealakekua Bay, reworking the Captain Cook Monument, was and is about a bit of for a group of Hawaii-based artists and practitioners to think and feel critically and speculatively about what else the Captain Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay could be. So let's play the videos. And there are four.
Inversion, Captain James Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay. I am proposing a full inversion of the Captain James Cook Monument at Kealakekua Bay. This action involves the temporary removal of the obelisk with its base intact, if possible, and the digging of a hole deep enough to perfectly bury the entire structure pointed side down in the same exact location. In the end, what will be visible is a minimal rectangle with a rough or possibly cleaned up surface that is the exposed underside of the monument's original foundation. The intention here is to negate the commemoration of Captain Cook in Hawaii without removing the monument completely. The monument's continued and inverted existence reinforces its status as a symbol of discomfort, much like a thorn that has embedded itself in flesh. The obelisk, once reaching to the heavens, now pierces lands and waters of a place forever transformed. Lawrence Seward, October 14th, 2019.
The 2018 Kealakekua Bay State Historical Park Master Plan Improvements Draft Environmental Impact Statement Report outlines several design alternatives for the site. One proposal indicates a seating area for visitors adjacent to the current Captain Cook Monument. When I was reviewing the 800-page document, an alternative idea offered by a community member, Uncle Steve, stuck out to me. Build a replica of the monument, place it at a mall parking lot, and tell visitors that is the real thing. On May 8, 2019, I traveled to Kealakekua Bay to conduct my own site visit of the Captain Cook Monument. After reaching the monument at 3:15 p.m., I photographed and then measured the obelisk. Then I went about reconstructing the site and the monument with a digital modeling software for further analysis, as would an architect. The obelisk at Kealakekua Bay differs significantly from other monuments erected in honor of Captain Cook. That is, it is not a bronze statue. Reproduced in shadow, the obelisk is a technology of time, the architecture of the clock itself. Within the parameters of the digital modeling software, I programmed the date to February 14th to contemplate the sunlight in Kealakekua Bay at the time of Captain Cook's death. In a history of time, so much is tied to the obelisk and how time and the planet is measured. This is true especially in architecture and design theory as it relates to urbanism and modernism. After analyzing the monument and site as a virtual digital model, I became obsessed with the real possibility to reproduce the obelisk myself in an architectural process called digital fabrication. How might this transformation, this shrinking in scale, lead to unanticipated pathways? In November 2019, using a computer-controlled cutting machine, I carved the mold of the obelisk from high-density foam and cast a 3/4-inch scaled replica of the obelisk with plaster. Suddenly, having a 21-inch tall version of the obelisk, new possibilities emerged. Amid the pandemic, lockdown, and my frustrations with colonialism and transportation, I was drawn to explore portraiture. On April 11th, 2020, I took a self-portrait with the replica of the obelisk I had produced. It was the only way in that moment for me to come to terms with myself, the concept of the monument, and the conundrums of time as imposed by the so-called Western world. Finally, I was bigger than the obelisk. Sean Connolly, August 2018 to April 2020.
A speculative proposal for this Captain Cook monument. I'm an anarchist and I cannot stand monuments. They always represent state power or some evil power, even revisionist ones do. I particularly hate monuments that are dedicated to individuals. Human beings are messy, complex, flawed, and for them to symbolize this kind of power is so wrong. Now, when I look at these images, I have to admit that they give me a certain amount of satisfaction, but I find them to be too aggressive, too violent, and wasteful in terms of material. Now, don't get me wrong. I think remembering the past is important. Like the diggers, for example, commoners that lived in 17th century in the place that we now know as England. These folks inspire me every single day. These are the folks that resisted the burgeoning nation state and capitalism enclosing the common land from them. And they resisted by tearing up the hedges, filling in the ditches, and growing edible food. One of their leaders is Gerard Winstanley. He co-authored this brochure. There's no photographs of him because this was before photography. And I have yet to see a single drawing of him. In spite of this, the city of his birth erected a monument, even though he didn't live there for very long. So my suspicion is that they did this for tourism more than anything else. So I have an idea, simple idea, inspired by birdseed cakes. They're simple to make, all natural materials. So I propose to replace Winstanley's monument as a bird feeder until it's all gone. And I'd like to apply the same logic to other monuments. Let's replace them all with bird seeds. Every monument in Hawaii. And why not apply it to the entire world, particularly to this gigantic one that a pharaoh exploiting thousands and thousands of slaves to make a monument just to dedicate it to himself. I will stop here.
If we are honoring a history of Kealakekua Bay, who does that history center on? Who does it memorialize? A British captain responsible for spreading disease throughout the Pacific? Or the people who put an end to his destruction? Those who finished the job? An article in Kanupepa Kuoko'a, Volume 6, Number 14, published on April 6, 1867, includes the following excerpt from Hawaiian historian Samuel M. Kamakau. Ina e no'ono'o kākou I ka mo'olelo o ka pena kuke, mai ka mua a hope, a'ole I loa'a ia'u kona I noa hemolele, a me kona I noa maika'i. Ina e kukulu ia I kia ho mana'o no kalani mano o ka ho'ovaha, no kona pepehi ana I ke kupu e ukolohe o ka pena kuke, ina ua oe ka ponoloa. If we consider the history of Captain Cook from start to end, I do not come out with a flawless name or a good name for him. If there is built a memorial to Kalani Mano o ka ho'ovaha for his killing of the destructive scamp, Captain Cook, that would be something most appropriate. I hope to place a sculpture at Kealakekua in front of the current Cook Monument. This is a remarking of the area that keeps with the way our ancestors honored story place. A ki'i of the Kanaka who is referenced as the killer of Cook, Kalani Mano o ka ho'owaha. This is Kori Kamehana o Kala Holt Tom, September 2020.
Can everyone hear me?
We can, and we can see you now too, Greg.
Yeah, great. I think this is where I dive in and keep things moving forward. Iatawacha drew and heloa mina palawa warunda palawardia mina lutianina warunda lutianina in Palawa language, Palawakani language. I've acknowledged my own ancestors and paid respect to you and the ancestors that stand with you today and welcome you, at least virtually, to the country here, La Truita. Look, I very, very much enjoyed and was absorbed in several different directions at once. And so thank you for bringing those short films and your introduction. And I would love to spend the next 3 or 4 days talking about this. It's something of great importance here. We've been struggling with the idea of monuments because of the things that have happened here. We have a notion here of creating a truth and reconciliation park to acknowledge and honour Aboriginal people who died during the frontier wars here. The Black War, as it was called. And we ended up deciding that rather than having an edifice or a monument, we would create a space within which things could happen. So we avoided the whole issue in some ways. We kind of, I don't know whether it's a cop-out or not, but I'm loving some of the things that were said just now, especially the idea, I think, of Lawrence Seward's, that these obelisks are like a thorn in our flesh. They are a perpetual irritant. and the various strategies that are proposed of you know, subtractive, additive, all seeking perhaps some sort of restorative outcome, I worked on these objects, these inanimate objects, which are nevertheless incredibly powerful in the name of individuals from the past. They're powerful, I think, because they have occurred across all cultures. I'm thinking of, you know, Rapa Nui, so famous. I'm thinking of the totem poles from Haida. I'm thinking of the going back to Babylonian and Sumerian and Egyptian monuments. It's like a domain, a virtual domain, where there's some sort of epistemological war continues across time, and it doesn't take much to stir up those hornets, and we've seen that in recent times, and it brings back to life issues that might have been become a little quieter lately. In Australia, Aboriginal deaths in custody, we had a big Royal Commission 30 years ago. Since that time, twice the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are dying in custody than were at the time of the inquest. So it shouldn't be surprising that this has been brought up by issues around monuments and Black Lives Matter. And that's the questions about the monuments themselves are really difficult and somewhat abstract, but I'd like to ask you about something maybe a little more achievable, about the people, the figures, or the historical figures, the myth of these figures in history. So these artists, through various individual processes, collective processes, are trying to give us opportunities to understand these figures differently. In the case of Captain Cook, for example, is he a hero? Is he a martyr? Is he a villain? Is he some sort of devil? How do we use monuments to understand these figures differently? I'm not sure who wants to put their hand up first to respond to that.
Drew, you go first.
Sure.
Drew, please.
Thanks for that question, Gray. Maybe I just wanted to return to something you said, which was about what it means to hold space and time together. And I think if we understand monuments as holding space and time to gather and not as honoring individuals, I think there's a way to, for me at least personally, to approach them without the anger or the kind of uncertainty. Because I'm much more willing to go to a space to be in relation with others than I am to go to that space to honor someone like Captain Cook. I'm not really sure how we reframe the conversation around monuments to understand them as holding space and time for conversation instead of perpetuating the legacy of an individual or the country that they represent. But that would be a hope that I have.
Mm. I'm thinking about Gay Chan's comment that monuments are wasteful, and perhaps if we only think of them as structures in time rather than recognise that they are structures that are active in time, then we're also wasting opportunities. Heloa, what do you think?
Well, you know, there was another artist who was originally part of this group invited to participate in kind of reimagining projects that maybe would never happen, but that were worth thinking critically and creatively about together. And her name is Bernice Akamine. And I really wanted her to be a part of this presentation. I kind of didn't give up hope until the very end, but really what she said is like, you know, that monument, that's like part of tourist culture. I don't know anybody who goes there. It doesn't live within our everyday. And she was sort of at a loss. And I think in some ways I was like, that's amazing, because her practice is so based on a very different kind of visual inheritance. Her references are ones informed by Kanaka Weevee and not by Captain Cook. And she thought this monument doesn't really exist in our consciousness. It's managed by the park system and how many locals go there. You know, she just thought, like, she kind of was at a loss when it came to rethinking what it could be. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's so true. I mean, if it's out of consciousness and there are other visual references and other visual legacies that are, you know, generative and restore relationships between people and the land, then how amazing is that? Like, I just thought, like, her response was an incredible response, actually, even though what she said was, I'm sort of, you know, stumped. So I think, you know, there is even validity in artists who acknowledge the fact that the monument here in Hawaii, given the fact that it is managed by a park system, is just sort of outside of the way we think and act every day. And so the monument is not activated as it might be in other places. And I would say, you know, if we were talking about different figures, people whose names and legacies are very much activated because their impact is still, you know, their names are still all over the place. There are more figures and I think like references to them within people's everyday, Bernice might have had a different response.
So how can we engage with these existing monuments in order to readdress these other figures in history? How can we subvert a monument to Cook, for example, into a process that shines a badly needed light on some perhaps even more important conversations about people or other historical figures?
Drew?
I think maybe the first step is to ensure that the monument is historically accurate. And I think that in and of itself is a huge process. But, you know, a small word like discovered, you know, that perpetuates a certain perspective of a historical narrative that, as Hila is saying, many people who live here and are of this land do not have. So perhaps it's not so much the call for complete erasure as it is a sort of an adjustment to ensure that history is accurately conveyed through publicly accessible information. Another example that comes to mind in Hawaii is the statue of U.S. President McKinley, who has in his right hand a document that is engraved with the words Treaty of Annexation. And, you know, that is a fictional account of history. And maybe it's as simple as filling in those words so that it's just a document in his hand. It's not a document that's a treaty of annexation, because there was no treaty of annexation. So maybe the first step is to just make small adjustments to these public monuments so that they better reflect an account of history that doesn't center on whiteness. Yeah.
The activity of these monuments in time, I feel sometimes are also, they can also serve to distract attention to a past that is somewhat remote. When instead people should be aware of what's happening right now. And I think that's maybe that's why global movements such as Black Lives Matter are energized by these monuments. So is there a temporal dimension to the task of artists who are intervening with these at these sites of conscience?
Yeah, I think so. I think that you know, people of our time would interpret and respond very differently than the people of like my parents' generation, for example. And to Drew's point, you know, like the visual accounts that surround us were just implied a particular history. And I think when those markers are removed, on one hand, we're sort of liberated by it. On the other hand, we're left without the evidence that shows actually we were like force-fed all this stuff. It surrounded us everywhere. And so I think, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a response that considers like where we are in the moment. And I think the challenge, what we are challenged by is to try and think in the future, what will the next generation actually want from us? There's a quote by a woman, and her name is Kamalu Poipoi, and she wrote, "The knowledge of my ancestors matters. It is important." And every time I say that to myself, I have it on a post-it on my desk. I think to myself, the knowledge of my descendants is important. And what do I want them to inherit? You know, like me as a conduit in this particular moment in time, what is it that my descendants will need to know of their ancestors? And I don't know that monuments are the most effective way to communicate what they will actually need.
Well, especially if their activity is mostly in a tourism space, it's almost bizarre and absurd, isn't it? That it's almost a failure. I mean, these things are not operating as a cog in the machine of state or religion or profound belief. They've become a trinket in themselves. I'd like to think. Can we make them more so that way? Can we emphasize? I mean, what do we have to add? We've talked about subtraction. What do we need to assert in the process of decolonizing these objects, these agents in time? Drew?
In the context of Kealakekua, I think what needs to be asserted is what has persisted across time, but has not been acknowledged, or is only acknowledged by those who live it and know it and inherit it, as Hialoha was speaking to. So I think across the bay, there's a heiau that was constructed by Kalaniopu Pu, called Hikiao. And that heiau has stood, its stones have stood firm across time. And yet, when I first went to Kealakekua, my reference point was the Captain Cook Monument, not a sacred space constructed by Kalaniopu Pu. Why? You know, that's a question I have to ask myself. Why is the history that I know the history of Captain Cook and not the history of Kalaniopu Pu constructing that space, even though it's just on the other side of the bay? So I think in terms of what we assert, perhaps in this context, we assert our culture. We assert it as something that lives, that transforms, and that persists across time. And what that looks like, I don't know. But I definitely know what it feels like.
For most of us, that culture comes not just from ancestors, but from what we call here country. I'm sure you have different language for that. And there's a question just come in through Slido, and please, those of you who are watching, submit some questions, and they'll be moderated, and I'll do my best to put the most intriguing of them forward. Somebody has just pointed out that country itself is replete with monuments, old trees, rivers, mountains, these things are not just geological or geographical, they are living things. Do you see these as monuments that have perhaps been neglected, or have we been distracted? Has our attention been distracted away from country?
I think that's a big conversation in Hawaii right now, and I'd say the equivalent to, you know, we also talk about country, certainly, but we also talk about aina. So there's a phrase, aloha aina, it means love of land and love of country, and those two things being the same, love of land, love of country. But, you know, we don't conserve land, we are the land. that's how we look at land and humans. We are the land. We are descended of it. And so the features of the land are something we strive to merge ourselves with. And if we don't do that, we hardly have the right to speak on the land's behalf. And so the people who do merge themselves with the land are the ones who have that right and that responsibility. And those are the people we listen to. And oftentimes they're the ones who bear that knowledge. When they look at the features, the natural features, they see something I don't see. And yet, if you were to come to Kulio'o, where my family has lived for generations, I would see things you wouldn't see. And it would be up to me to disclose them and share them or not. And that's just how it is. And I think that those are the epic monuments that withstand time. And because we have a very animate culture in Hawaii, there's a lot of responsibility to nurture land. So conservation, this idea that people live apart from the land, is actually a form of abandonment and neglect in Hawaiian culture. You have to be there to steward the land or you are being irresponsible. And so to your point, how are we kind of not necessarily responding to these existing monuments and these epic figures and stories? And, I think there are lots of references in Hawaiian culture where if humans don't see themselves as stewards and part of the environment themselves, the environment leaves. Aspects of the environment will leave. And so I would love to get to the place where, yet again, people consider the land the monument that we interact with and activate and restore and also then are regenerated by.
I see Kane's face, and I suspect he's got his timekeeper role in mind. But I'd love to hear just something from you, Drew, on that subject of country before we wind up.
Yeah, maybe I'll approach it through.
We've lost your sound.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
I'd like to approach that question through a sort of kind of honoring of contemporary Native Hawaiian art, which emerged from my perspective in the early 1970s and was entwined with what Hila offered in terms of aloha aina. Contemporary art, Native Hawaiian artists were imbued with the energy of a people in a place that hadn't been felt for a long time. And that was intimately connected to remembering to care for the land, for that which sustains us. And that expressed itself in lots of different ways across the archipelago, mostly in resistance against U.S. empire. It's not so much a history, like an eon-long history, right? It's 50 years. But that's sort of where I'm at in my own development. I connect to a discussion of aina through my understanding of contemporary Native Hawaiian artists and how that position is dependent on care of the land.
Waleka, thank you. It's just been a real pleasure and an honor to be able to have this conversation with you both. And what a shame we're not sitting in the same room together. But I hope one day we might be able to sit down together and talk more. Thank you very much. Kane.
Thank you, Greg. I think you started off so accurately by saying we could actually be here for days talking about this. And as I was just listening in, not worrying about the time until I was prompted about it, I don't even know how to begin to summarize it, but I might just say there was a few things that stood out for me, not being exhaustive, obviously, of this discussion, but that notion of, I'm remembering sort of John Powell's work, the American civil rights advocate, the opposite of othering is not sameness, but belonging. And really made me reflect on your conversation that you've been having, about how then that shows up through asserting of the culture that exists. And it sort of tied in with your comments as well about you know, how important it is to see ourselves in the land of which, in the community of which we're part of. And maybe that was responded really well by the four provocations that we saw. And there's wonderful words, and I can't remember, my apologies, who said it, but to be in space and time together, to be with people. And that sort of just reminds me of that belonging concept as well. You know, in doing a little bit of research on sort of on Hawaii as well, and I learned the motto of, you know, the state of Hawaii as well, and how it draws on that land piece, Greg, that you were mentioning as well, you know, and I thought it was just beautifully summed up. Hey, aloha, you claimed, you know, we are the land, and perhaps really what we can do as well is continue to nurture that contemporary art that is alive and that keeps that culture alive as well through our sculptors as well. So thank you so much, Greg, for facilitating this dialogue. Thank you so much, Ialoha and Drew. It really, really wonderful to have you all here with us.